river. Its sound and size astounded me. The banks wild and wide, the speed of the current readable in the branches and leaves that raced along its surface. I had never seen water move this way. She stood waist high in the river, the water curling around her. I remember the way she looked in that moment, that violent euphoria barely sheathed behind the lips. The water curled around her wounded body, and as it moved, it did not heal her wounds. It cauterized. She was motionless. I waved at her to come closer to the riverbank, but she seemed not to see me at all. She was breathing hard, though she had not run. She looked in that moment like a child, wide-eyed, uncertain. Then it dawned on me. She was afraid. And then she was gone, fully submerged as though weighted with anvils. When she surfaced, her baggy shirt held fast to her skin and pins of light glimmered on her shaven head. "Come here," she said. I shook my head.
"I'm scared."
"Good," she said. "Now you have something you can kill. Come here." I faced down the river. Everything I had known of the world suddenly felt very far away. I saw that beyond the river there was a high wall, lined with razor wire and manned by guards. And although I wouldn't be able to articulate what I felt until much later, I knew then that the bulk of the world was just like this. Wild, unvaccinated, malicious. I stepped into the river. It was only a few footsteps before the soft, polished floor fell from beneath my feet, and I was taken by the current. I screamed, but her hands were quickly on me. She held me afloat and carried me in further. The sound of water was like a million invisible mouths all whispering at once. The water was alive. I knew it because the water was moving. I looked at her then, and I saw a thing I'd never seen before. My aunt was laughing. Excerpted from The Civil War Archive Project. Reunification Day Ceremony Invitation Letter. Cleared. Unclassified. Governor Timothy Combs, 391 West Paces Ferry Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. Dear Governor Combs, at the direction of President Joseph Weiland, Jr., it is my pleasure to formally extend to you an invitation to the National Reunification Summit in Columbus, Ohio, on Friday, July 3, 2095. As the President has previously stated, the summit will turn the page on a dark chapter in our great nation's history. Civic leaders, including yourself, from across the Union, will gather in Columbus to declare what has been, since the dawn of this country, self-evident: that we are a nation forever indivisible. For security and logistical reasons, travel to Columbus from several states, including Georgia, will be restricted in the months preceding and immediately following the summit. As such, please respond at your earliest convenience with details of your travel party, maximum 4, so as to allow the Peace Office time to perform the necessary security checks and issue the required travel permits. This is a momentous day for our Union, Governor. A day to celebrate the courage of all Americans who fought so gallantly for what they believed in. But also, a day to put years of heartache behind us and begin the difficult but vital work of healing. A day to rejoice and to rebuild. I look forward to meeting with you and all the other delegates from the great state of Georgia at the formal reunification ceremony and the grand parade to follow. Sincerely, Malcolm Kaysen, Deputy Secretary to the Director of Southern Affairs, Peace Office, Department of Defense, 1 Columbus Commons, Columbus, Ohio, 43215. Chapter 15. In late May, Scott came through and devastated Lincolnton. It was a small storm, but powerful, and although it just missed our home, it disrupted our daily routine. With the community center and the elementary school badly damaged, I found myself confined to the farm. I was thrilled with my good fortune. I had more time with Surratt. One day I found Surratt in the woodshed, hammering boards. The night before, My parents had gone to a party hosted by the fledgling southern arm of the New Reunificationists, who in those days were among the first to speak of peace as though peace meant victory. My parents decided to spend the night in Atlanta. My aunt and I had the farm to ourselves. I found her kneeling by the place where once she had removed the floor to expose the earth. She had beside her a fresh stack of fake cedar planks.
"What are you doing?"
I asked.
"Putting the boards back in," she said. "You take any more wood from this shed, the whole thing will come down."
"Can I help?"
"Sure."
She waved me over. I sat between her knees and she put the hammer in my hand. She held the nail in place.
"One soft one to set it, one hard one to drive it," she said.
I tried, but I couldn't bring the hammer down hard enough for fear I'd miss and hit her finger. Finally, I cracked the nail with enough force to move it, but at an angle. It splintered the wood.
"Better, better," my aunt said. "At least that did something."
She had me practice on the damaged plank until I perfected the motion. In half an hour, I'd hammered the board into the floor with so many nails, no force in the world could move it. I beamed at my handiwork. We covered half the hollow in the floor before the midday heat exhausted me. She suggested we go cool down in the river. With ease, she picked me up and set me on her shoulders. We walked out to the eastern edge of the property and over the seawall and out to where the stunted trees met the water. We stopped in a place where a soft beach of soil separated the willows. We sat for a moment while my aunt recovered from the long walk. I dug my hands deep into the earth. I learned on one of our earliest trips to the river that she liked to swim naked. The first time she'd taken off her clothes, she did so in the water, fearful I'd be frightened by the sight of her scars. But it didn't bother me. I'd seen them before, when I spied on her that night after she first arrived in our home. So I stripped down too. And from that day onward, it seemed unimaginable that anyone should step into the water clothed. We swam under the shade of the willows and the quarantine wall. On one of our trips to the river, I'd asked her why the wall was there. She said the people on the other side had been infected with a sickness, and the wall was built to keep them from making others sick. I asked her what kind of sickness. She said, "The kind where you don't ever get better. The kind you can't help but pass on to your children, and they to theirs." To the east, a guard looked on from the tower. I waved at him, but he didn't wave back. At first the guards scared me, but my aunt told me they were not human beings, just a pair of eyes unable to harm or help anyone or anything. I thought of them now in the same way I thought of the stick-figure children my mother had painted on the levee, and I was no longer scared. We dried ourselves in the sun, naked by the riverbank. Even now, her body astounded me, the strange rivulets of scarred skin that lined her upper arms and shoulders, dead-looking and paler than the rest of her. The way her breasts and stomach sagged, the smoothness of her shaved head. In her presence, I could think of nothing strong enough to harm us. Not the river, nor the wall, nor whatever lay beyond the wall.
"Is Dana your sister?"
I asked. The question had been weighing on my mind for weeks, ever since I heard her say Dana's name when she was talking to my father one night. I knew the woman in one of the pictures on our staircase wall was my other aunt, but my parents had never told me much about her. The question seemed to take her by surprise.
"That's right," she said. "My sister and your father's sister."
"Does she live in Atlanta?"
"No, she's dead."
"How did she die?"
I asked.
"You know the birds that fly around here sometimes?"
"Sure."
"Well, they're empty now. They just fly around doing nothing until their solar panels break down or their wings crack and they crash in a field somewhere. But before you were born, they used to be weapons. They used to drop bombs from their stomachs."
It seemed such a ridiculous thing. Birds that drop bombs from their stomachs. But like the squiggly things in the soil, or the fish with whiskers, or the old coastal cities now buried underneath the sea, I believed it.
I believed it because she said it. You know, she lives right here now. My sister? Surratt pointed at the water. After she died, instead of burying her in the ground, I buried her in the river.
Why?
I asked. I wanted her to never stop moving.
If I die, will you bury me in the river?
My aunt chuckled. It'll be a good long while before you die, she said. I'll be gone before then.
How about if you die?
I said.
Do you want me to bury you in the river?
She was dumbstruck, as though she'd never considered it before. She smiled.
Yeah,
she said. I'd be grateful if you did. I leaned against her arm and put my own arm around her. She was mine, and I loved her. When we returned from the river, there was a man at the gate. He was a stranger to me, dressed in a fine pre-war suit and a green tie. He stood just outside the gate, his car parked in the driveway, peering in. We walked up the road to meet him. It wasn't until we were very close to the gate that my aunt's damaged eyes finally made out the stranger. She stood a long time staring at him, her face empty. "Go on inside, Benjamin," she said. "I'll be in a minute." I asked her who the man was, but she ordered me inside again in a tone that let me know it was best not to ask any more questions. She opened the gate. She inspected the man who stood before her, the man she hadn't seen in many years. He had aged, but he had aged well. The silver wings of hair and the thick black mustache, now also graying, were little changed from when she'd last seen him among the ruins of Lake Sinclair all those years ago.
"Hello, Joe," she said. "I thought you'd be long gone by now."
"Hello, Surratt," said Joe. Instantly, she recognized his faraway accent. "I'm sorry I didn't visit sooner. I didn't know they had set you free." She ushered him to the woodshed. I watched them from my bedroom window, hoping to catch a snippet of their conversation, but they walked silently and shut the door behind them. I only learned what he said to her later, when I read it. By then, it was too late. They sat on stools by the workbench. She saw that he had not changed. His cool air of charm the same as it had been in their old clandestine meetings.
"He's a cute boy," said Joe, pointing in the direction of the house.
He's my nephew."
"I see.
How are you, Surratt?" he asked.
"Alive," my aunt replied. "I want to say, first of all, that I didn't know what Albert Gaines had done. A long time ago, he'd sent his daughter and her mother to live in the Buazizi Empire, so they would be safe during the war. And I'm told his interrogators told him they'd learned of their whereabouts, and used it as leverage against him. He was not a coward when I knew him, Surratt, and I..."
"Don't," she said.
"It doesn't matter."
Joe nodded. She saw that he was doing now what everyone she'd known from before her time in prison had done. He was staring, trying to reconcile the shape and size and damage of her now with the recollected image of the lanky teenager he'd once known. Finally, he said, "I know what they must have done to you in that place, Surratt, and I am truly sorry."
"You didn't come here just to tell me that."
"That's correct," Joe said.
"I understand that you were able to meet one of your old prison guards. I understand that you were able to exact some measure of revenge."
Surratt laughed. "Revenge," she echoed. "Revenge. Revenge. I hurt one man. Do you think it was just one man who hurt me?"
If you would like, I can ask my contacts to look for others, Joe said. Many of the guards who were stationed at Sugarloaf when you were there are back on the mainland now. Perhaps, why stop there? She said. Why don't you line them all up for me? Can you do that, Joe? You line up every man who made me what I am. The ones who killed my father, the ones who killed my sister, the ones who killed my mother, the ones who made it so my brother will never be whole again, the ones who drove us from our home, the ones who slaughtered all those people in patience. You line up the whole lot of them for me, Joe. Then I'll have my revenge.
Hans, supposing I could? Joe asked.
A grimace of light shone through the cracks in the boards.
Say what you mean, my aunt replied.
For several years, I cultivated a relationship with a young man in the north, said Joe. A man named Tusk, a scientist who has dedicated his life to finding a cure for the disease the Blue Government once used to silence the people of South Carolina. But even though he spent many years trying, he failed. And in the process, he created something far worse. Another disease of sorts, capable of wiping out entire cities, entire nations. He is in many ways a broken man, Surratt. And last year I arranged a deal with him. In exchange for the thing he created, I have offered him refuge in my home country, away from the war and everything he has had to endure. The reunification ceremony is coming up in a few months. The war will be over. And no matter what your new southern politicians say, it will have been won by the North. But if someone were to go to Columbus and release this disease, it would change the tide of the war. Change the victor. Change everything. I want to know if you wish to be the one to do it, Surratt. A silence shrouded the room. Light turned to heat on the still uncovered soil. He waited on her answer.
You don't need me to do it, she said.
That's right. I could have one of my contacts in the north do it. It would be much easier to do it that way, I suspect. The Blues have thousands of new guards on patrol at the border crossings, and the ones I used to have some influence with are gone. But I wanted to offer it to you first, because I know how much you have fought and how much you have suffered. You want something the size of your vengeance, Surratt? This, I believe, is the size of your vengeance. They heard a fleeting sound outside, a laborer wheeling fresh soil to the greenhouses. Then it was quiet again.
Tell me your real name, my aunt said.
My real name is Youssef Ben Rashid. I am 71 years old. I work for the government of the Bouazizi Empire.
Youssef,
Surratt repeated, letting her tongue whip every syllable.
Youssef. It doesn't really matter to you, does it?
She asked.
Who wins this war?
No, it does not.
Then why? Why be a part of it?
I come from a new place, Surratt, Youssef said. My people have created an empire. It is young now, but we intend it to be the most powerful empire in the world. For that to happen, other empires must fail. I think by now you understand that, if it were the other way around, if the South was on the verge of winning, perhaps I would be having this conversation in Pittsburgh or Columbus. I don't want to lie to you, Surratt. This is a matter of self-interest, nothing more. Surratt smiled at the thought.
You couldn't just let us kill ourselves in peace, could you?
Come now, said Youssef. Everyone fights an American war. They were both quiet, and in the silence, Surratt was reminded of something Albert Gaines had told her. He asked her once if she knew how the word red came to be shorthand for the South. She said it was politics, something to do with who voted for the old Republican Party back when it was all still one country. But Gaines said it was older than all that, older than the country itself. He said it was about the dirt. In the South, there's a mineral in the ground that turns the dirt red. He said when you've leached all the good from the earth, all the nutrients that a seedling needs to grow, the last thing left is the stuff that turns the dirt red. She wondered now if maybe that was the only honest thing he'd ever told her.
It'll kill everyone it touches. This sickness you have, she asked Yusuf.
You have my word, Yusuf replied.
I'm never going back to that prison. No matter what happens, I'm never going back.
You have my word. She stood from her stool and walked to the doors and flung them open. Blistering daylight flooded the shed. She looked out at the new house that stood where the old one used to be, and at the wilting trees and the river imprisoned by walls. The world about her shook with heat.
Do you ever get sick of this place, Yusuf? She asked. Ever wish you could just be done with it? Just go home? Back to your family? Back to the world you know?
Of course, Yusuf replied. I hope to go home one day soon.
Me too, she said.
From then on, she was distant. Once more she barricaded herself in that shed, just like she did when she first arrived. This time the door was closed and locked. I couldn't see inside. I was so desperate to reach her that I spent hours kneeling outside the shed's back wall with my ear against the boards, listening. All I ever heard was the scratch of old pen on paper. I lay awake at night wondering what I had done to drive her away. Was she disappointed in me? Had I failed to defeat the river current one too many times? Had I nagged her with too many questions? Did I bore her? In desperation, I scribbled the word sorry on a blank sheet of paper and slid it under her door. She made no reply. On a Saturday in the middle of June, while my parents were at a farmer's trade show in Montgomery, she left the house for a day. We kept a used tick-tock on the property for emergencies. She took it. She drove to the market in Lincolnton. It was a smaller crowd than usual, the town still cleaning up the last of the damage from Hurricane Scott. She walked past the half-empty stalls to the end of the road, where Marcus stood watch. Without speaking, they went to the church nearby. This time, she went in first, and he followed.
"Goddamn, I'm glad you showed up today," said Marcus. "You know what I just heard from one of the Free Southerner boys? You remember that old man, Prince Wendell, used to run a coffee shop out in the middle of the ocean? They're going to name a street in Atlanta after him. Guess someone on one of those reunification prep committees heard about him, and they decided to do it. Thought it would look good to honor a man who worked with both sides. I thought you'd get a kick out of..."
"Sit down," my aunt said. "I need to talk to you."
Marcus sat beside her on the pew.
"Sure," he said. My aunt handed her friend a small folded piece of paper. On it was written the name and contact information of a man.
"There's someone I know. I want you to go talk to him. He can arrange for you to leave this place, to leave all of this, and go start a new life on the other side of the world."
Marcus stared at the paper, confused.
"Surratt, it's all coming to an end," he said. "In a few months, there's going to be no more war. It'll all be one country again. And then, I swear to you, you won't believe how quickly everyone forgets all about this."
My aunt shook her head.
"Please, Marcus. Just go see him."
Marcus took the paper from her hand.
"The war is over, Surratt," he said. And this time, it didn't sound as though he was trying to reassure her.
"I know, Marcus," she said. She kissed him. She stood.
"I know."
She left Lincolnton and drove west to the outer suburbs of Atlanta. In the shadows of the factories and the vertical farms, she went to Stone Mountain, on the easternmost outskirts of the city. Near the dilapidated flat bungalows of the old village, there stood an unmarked red brick storefront. It was to this meager slice of real estate that the United Rebels had been relegated. When she arrived, she found only Adam Bragg Jr. and Troff in the office. It was a small space, once a restaurant or a bakery, and longer than it was wide. Chairs stood upturned on their tables except for where Bragg sat, nursing a cup of coffee. He stood when he saw her.
"Well, hello there," he said. "Who'd have thought the great Surratt Chestnut would come visit us in our new home?"
He beckoned her to the chair opposite him at the table. Even stripped of its old cash register and front counter, the place felt claustrophobic, the walls lined with cheap, dark wood and decorated with ancient posters that urged, "Have a Coke." Troff stood in the back of the room, near where the chairs and tables gave way to stacks of unopened moving boxes. The first time she had seen him after her release from Sugarloaf, on the day they took her to meet her old captor, she hadn't recognized him. But he looked familiar now. Thin like his older brother, eyes numb and accusing.
"Can you believe it's come to this?" said Bragg. "Cast out into the wilderness, disowned by our own people. You know what they put in that building we used to be in? The one downtown, under the highway, after they forced us out? The new office of the Reunification Celebration Committee."
He laughed and shook his head.
"They got a whole building of people deciding where to hang the balloons and send the marching bands to celebrate the day we surrender. Jesus, I wish my dad was alive to see it. It would have killed that old bastard twice."
"I need your help," my aunt said. Bragg motioned for Troff to make more coffee. With his eyes still on my aunt, the young man complied.
"Name it," Bragg said. "We ain't got much, but what we got is yours."
"If I told you I could turn it all around, kill every last one of them who run the Blue, wipe out the North, make it so they don't see the sun for 100 years, would you believe me?"
"Yeah, I'd believe you," said Bragg. "I wouldn't believe anybody else who said it, but I'd believe you."
Troff placed a cup of coffee on the table and returned to his post, watching. "I need you to get me across the border," my aunt said. "I need to be in Columbus for the reunification ceremony."
"Christ, Surratt, it can't be done," said Bragg. "They got more men guarding the Tennessee line ahead of that goddamn ceremony than they did during the height of the war. Every crossing's a fortress, and they ain't letting a single Southerner through, probably not until the end of the year."
"What about the tunnels?" my aunt asked. "The ones we used to crawl through to get near Halfway Branch."
"Surratt, they demolished those years ago. That world don't exist no more. Hell, other than Troff here, I got 3, maybe 4 good men left. They wore our people down. Everyone's tired and hungry, and they all lost the will for war. Go see it for yourself on your way back home. Drive into Atlanta proper. Look at all those billboards the Free Southern State put up. Peace with dignity, respecting our past, securing our future. All that horse shit. And people eat it up. You know, they don't even call themselves the Free Southern State anymore. They just use the acronym. Never spell it out, like the letters don't mean nothing. They're waving their cowardice around like a goddamn flag."
"I know a way," said Troff. "I know how you can get to Columbus."
Bragg fell silent.
"How?" my aunt asked.
Troff came to the table.
"There's a medical shuttle that goes up north. St. Joseph's has a deal with a hospital up in Lexington. They get to ship a few people up there on the first of every month. They cap it at 12 patients and they keep it quiet. But I know the guy who runs it. He and my brother spent some time up at the Tennessee line together. He owed my brother a favor from back then, and there's no one but me left to collect. I'll tell him I got a friend who'll die if she don't get treatment up north. He'll bump someone and put you on. And soon as you cross the border, you can make your way to Columbus."
Bragg stared at his lieutenant, dumbfounded. He turned to my aunt.
"But if you're really going to kill as many as you say, that means you're going to take something with you. A weapon, a bomb, something. And just because it's a medical shuttle, don't mean the Blues won't search it."
"They won't find what I'm bringing," my aunt said. "They can search me all they want. They won't find it. I have one condition,
said Troth.
What's that?
My aunt asked.
I go with you. The thing I'm going to use, you can't aim it. It's a sickness, a kind that will spread to every last one of them in Columbus. Nobody going on this trip is coming back.
I go with you, said Troth.
No.
Let him, Surratt, said Bragg. He's been rotting here praying to be with his family for going on 10 years. Give him what he wants. You owe it to his brother, just like that man from St. Joe's.
I don't owe anybody a single thing,
my aunt said.
Bragg sighed and rubbed his temples.
Let me ask you something, Surratt. During all that time you spent in Sugarloaf getting interrogated, did they ever once ask you whether you had anything to do with the killing of that blue general, Wyland?
No.
But that's the one thing you actually did. All that other stuff they must have asked you about, you probably didn't have a single useful thing to tell them. But the one guy you killed, they never once asked you about him. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, my aunt said.
I'll tell you why. They didn't ask you about it because 2 days after they picked you up, that boy Attic walked right up to the blue border guards at Harrogate and turned himself in. He told them it was him who killed the general. He made them believe it. Told them all the details he knew from listening to us talk about it, except with him as the shooter. Now they got him locked away in Sugarloaf too, in a place called Camp Sunday, where they keep the ones they won't even do the mercy of killing. That's why they never asked you about the one thing you did, Surratt. That's why you're free.
That was his choice, my aunt said. I never asked him to do it.
Nobody asked him to do it. But that don't change the fact he did. And it don't change the fact that you're alive and sitting here now because of it.
Bragg pointed at Troth.
I know you've been through hell, Surratt. I know you had things done to you, and I know you were a different girl before. But these boys never even had it before. They were dead before they got a shot at living. Give him what he wants. Let him be with his brothers.
Troth stood at the table, eyes blue and still, his face unchanged.
Make it happen, my aunt told him.
And you can come with me.
Troth nodded. The last of the Salt Lake boys left the old brick store. Bragg stood. He walked to the back of the room, where the unopened moving boxes lay stacked. He began to rummage through them.
You know, I always used to wonder what lines he used on you,
Bragg said.
Who used on me?
Gaines, when he's trying to recruit you. He had all these different plans of attack, you know, when he's trying to bring someone into the fold. Like if a kid was religious, he'd start talking to him about how it was God's will for the South to emerge victorious. Or if they were insecure, he'd talk to him about the ever-accepting rebel family. But he always told my father, you were too sharp for all that. Too curious, too. What was the word he used? Truculent. I had to go look that one up. He said if the course of life don't recruit her to the cause, no man will.
Bragg returned to the table, a small bronze star in hand.
Well, Surratt Chestnut,
I thank God the course of life recruited you.
He set the star on the table and passed it to her. It was a pin. Rusted and slightly warped.
My father had these made a long time ago, said Bragg. He had them cast in the style of the old Southern state flag. Did you know they drew the stars on that flag all wrong? Had the right face and edges longer than the others. Never bothered to fix it. My father had all these grand visions of a proper Southern rebel army, and so he had these little medals of valor made up so he could hand them out for meritorious military service in the war against the Northern enemy.
Bragg chuckled.
Poor bastard didn't even get to hand out one.
My aunt held the rebel star in her hand. The pin in the back held fast to its catch with rust and would not open.
Is it really going to work, this thing you have?
Asked Bragg.
When you set it loose in Columbus, it'll be enough to kill all of them? The Blues, the Southern traitors, the whole lot of them?
Everyone. My aunt said. Bragg reached over and took my aunt's hand in his.
"You're gonna be remembered, Surratt," he said. "You'll be a hero to the Southern cause for as long as the South exists. When this is over, they'll build cities in your name."
My aunt pulled her hand away. She tossed the flawed star to the ground. She stood.
"Fuck the South," she said. "Fuck the South and everything it stands for."
She left Stone Mountain. She drove west through the capital and through the state into Alabama. She went to the forest. For the last time, she went to see Albert Gaines. The Talladega forest was thinner than she remembered it, the trees seemingly further apart. But the path to the cabin was the same, singed in her memory from all those times she'd stalked through this place, picking off cans, hunting rats. She intended to gut the old man the way she'd gutted the guard who'd drowned her. She opened the door and found him sitting inside, asleep in his chair. Bragg had told her he'd suffered a stroke in the detention camp, right after he and the other recruiters had been rounded up. She saw the damage on the right side of his face. He was sitting in an old, rusted wheelchair, wearing soiled pajamas whose stitching was coming apart. His hair was white and thin. He looked old, ancient. His breathing was a fine whistle, the air leaking out of his mouth. She understood then why none of the remaining rebels had come out here to put a bullet in his head and stuff his mouth with the lining of his pockets. It would have been a kindness. He woke at the sound of her footsteps. When he saw her, he recoiled and his breathing grew quicker. His mouth opened, but nothing came out. She saw his eyes darting like gas lamp flames. For a moment he looked her over, unsure, but she knew he recognized her. Just like she knew she would always recognize him. Even if it had just been a pile of bones she found when she walked into that shack, she'd know it was him. She looked around the room. Dirty dishes lined the table and filled the sink. There were clothes on the floor. Not the fine suits she remembered, but undershirts and cheap pants from the sweatshops down south. In one corner of the room, there was a bookshelf, but it was empty. On a table near the bed, she saw the old stereo Gaines used to keep in his office in Patience. Of all the things in the cabin, only the stereo showed no accumulation of dust. She set it to play. The old classical number filled the room, the song of the weary pilgrim. She knelt beside him. She drew in close. He was alien to her now, this feral, sickly old man. But what was inside him was still the same. He looked at her. Between the soft heaves of his breathing, he said, "My daughter." He said it again and again. "My daughter, my daughter." Every time, it sounded like an unfinished sentence, like there was more coming, but it was just those two words. And then his breathing halted, and for a moment she thought that he had left her, that this was his final act of abuse, to die before her. Then he exhaled, and with the exhale came all of what he had been trying to say.
"They said they would hurt my daughter."
She took the knife from her pocket, the knife he'd given her all those years ago. She opened his gnarled fingers to reveal the yellow skin of his palm. She gave it back to him. In late June, the storms subsided and new crops were born. For months, my mother had tried in secret to grow strawberries in the greenhouses, and suddenly the plants began to deliver. The leaves sagged with berries, thick as fists, dark and bursting with juice. My mother invited all her friends to come try the farm's newest produce, and all agreed the strawberries were the best they'd ever had. One night, my parents got into an argument. Afterward, my father went outside for a walk. Sometimes, when he wanted to be alone, he sat on the levee, looking out at the river and the quarantine wall. In a while, his sister emerged from her shed and joined him. They sat under the light of a copper moon. A westward wind made the willow leaves dance like charmed snakes. The river moved.
She wants to go north, after they sign the treaty,
my father said.
To Pittsburgh or upstate New York. She wants to sell the farm and the house and move there.
Surratt tried to gauge the state of her brother's lucidity, whether he was liable to leave her and wander to his clouded place.
And what do you want?
She asked.
I don't want to go.
The sound of humming motors came across the water. Somewhere, shielded by the night, a dredging ship slowly changed the shape of the river.
I remember when we were kids back in Louisiana, and Dad first said he was going up to the permit office in Baton Rouge and try to get a pass to the north,
my aunt said.
I still remember how much you hated him for it. You kept telling Dana and me how anyone that wants to go up to the Blue Country is a traitor. One time, I even saw you packing a little bag and burying it in the dirt near that raft you had. Like if Dad really tried to make us go north, you'd just take your things and sail off into the Mississippi Sea. Go live on one of those man-made islands in the Gulf.
She chuckled. She turned to look at her brother and saw that he was smiling, his eyes cast down at his feet.
You don't remember any of it, do you?
She said. My father shook his head.
It just gets away from me sometimes.
He rubbed his temple.
Truth is, I'd be happier if I didn't remember any of it, if there wasn't anything left of it at all.
My aunt watched the guards in their towers on the other side of the river. She wondered if it was the same boys from her youth who still guarded the quarantine wall. The only signs of them now were small, pulsing lights that blinked red against the darkness.
It's strange, isn't it? She said. What sticks with you and what doesn't? The things you decide to keep. The night after the massacre at Patience, I remember I'd sent Dana away and the soldiers had taken you to the morgue, thinking you were dead. But I didn't want to leave. Some of the bodies were still there. You could still smell that burning in the air from when they tossed the dead in the fire. But I wanted to stay. I wanted to find Mama. Anything that was left of her, even if it was just ash. Finally, the soldiers told me I had 10 minutes to get my things before they were going to tie me up and throw me on the last bus out. So I went back, and you know what I took? I took Dad's old statue, the Virgin of Guadalupe. I took that turtle Marcus and I kept as a pet. I took a couple of old photos from Mama's bunk. I didn't take any clothes, didn't take any of the money Mama had saved up all her life. Not a single useful thing. Just junk.
It wasn't junk,
my father said.
It was our past.
That's exactly what it was, she said.
There's this passage in one of the books Albert Gaines once gave me. It said in the South there is no future, only 3 kinds of past. The distant past of heritage, the near past of experience, and the past in waiting. What they've got up there in the blue, what your wife wants, what our parents wanted, is the future.
If we go up north,
my father asked,
will you come with us?
Don't ask me that, my aunt replied. An impotent bird flew overhead, invisible in the evening sky. She remembered the first time she'd heard one of them after she'd been released from Sugarloaf. How she instinctively dove to the ground, covered her ears, breathed out lest the pressure wave of a nearby blast shatter her lungs. And then later, rising from the floor, wondering how it could be that in all her waking hours since the day they drowned her, she felt not an ounce of will to live. And yet, in that moment of perceived danger, she had so quickly sought to protect herself, to stave off death. Why did the thought of violence against her only terrify her when it came at the hands of anyone but herself? She did not know.
I want you to do something for me, she said to her brother.
All right,
my father said. I want you to forgive me.
Forgive you for what?
For doing something terrible, my aunt said. For taking so much away from you.
You never took anything away from me, Surratt.
You took care of me. After patience. Karina told me how you came back for me, how everyone thought I was dead, but you and Dana wouldn't give up.
That's a lie. I wanted you to be dead. The first time I saw you after they brought you home, saw how badly they'd hurt you, I wished you'd never survived. That's what I am, Simon. Makes no difference now how I got to be that way. It's what I am. I don't want you to love me. I don't want you to tell me I did nothing wrong. I want you to know I did wrong, and I want you to forgive me. Please, I'm begging you. Just say you'll forgive me.
I forgive you,
my father said.
I forgive you.
She sank then into her brother's arms. And for the first time since she was a little girl at Patience, stained with the blood of the first man she ever killed, she wept. She never saw her brother again. The following morning, I woke just before dawn, startled by the sound of our car moving up the driveway. In the twilight, I saw my aunt park near the unused greenhouse in which she hid her secret things. I inched the bedroom window open and watched. She opened the trunk. Then she disappeared inside the greenhouse, shovel in hand. For a while, I saw nothing, but soon she emerged, her hands black with soil. I watched her take dozens of dirt-stained diaries from the greenhouse and pack them in the trunk of the car. Then she drove away from the house. The front gate opened, but the doorbell made no sound. She was gone the whole day. She returned in the early hours of the following morning. In the darkness, I heard her cavernous footfalls on the stairs. My bedroom door creaked open. There was no light, but I knew it was her. She came close to where I lay and knelt by my bedside. She turned on the lamp. It had been a long time since I'd seen her face so close. I felt the heat of her on me. I stared, wide-eyed. "Hey," she said, "you want to go on an adventure?" At the sound of that word, all the fog of sleep instantly left me. I nodded.
"Follow me," she said, "and be very quiet."
I watched her open my dresser drawers and pack a few changes of clothes into a small backpack.
"Here," she said, handing it to me. "You'll need this."
Still in my pajamas, I trailed her to the car outside. Slowly, she drove up the driveway, and I saw the wires hanging from the panel she'd broken, the one that made the doorbell ring. We slipped silently past the gate. I asked her where we were going, but she said it was a surprise. We seemed to drive forever, away from the sun. The sky was blue behind us, but black ahead. Eventually, I fell back asleep. When I woke, it was early afternoon, and we were in unfamiliar country. The highway along which the car raced was hugged by endless browning fields. I saw broken-down signs for motels and restaurants, of which only wreckage remained. We were coming up on water. I could see it in the distance. A vast, brown river, thick as honey. Again, I asked her where we were going, but she would not say. Before we reached the water, she pulled onto a small dirt road that scythed the path through the myrtle trees. The trees had lost their color, but the ground was littered with the remains of pink baptiza. We parked near one of the trees, around which a white strip of cloth had been tied. She got out of the car. I followed. For a while, she just stood there, saying nothing. I begged her to tell me what we were doing, but she simply told me to wait. I was still electric with the sense of adventure. A dark sedan rolled up the road to meet us. Two men emerged from the car. One was tall and burly, the other short, both bearded. The short one came to where we stood and looked me over.
"That him?" he asked.
"Yeah," my aunt said. "You know what to do?"
"Won't be a problem," the short man said. "Be about a month getting out to the coast, and however long the smugglers take, but we'll take good care of him. Don't you worry."
I watched her give two envelopes to the man. He opened one and counted the cash inside. The other had my name on it and was sealed.
"Don't give that one to him until he's a man," she said.
I asked her what was going on. She knelt down to face me.
You have to go with these men for a while, she said. They're gonna take you to a safe place. Don't worry. Everything's gonna be all right.
I don't want to go with them, I said. I want to stay with you.
I'm sorry, Benjamin, she replied. It has to be this way. The short man picked me up. I screamed and kicked at him, my heels driving into his shins. I begged her not to let me go. As the short man carried me to the waiting car, I saw the tall one shake Surratt's hand. I just wanted to say, it's an honor to finally meet you, Miss Chestnut, he said. I heard what you did at Halfway Branch way back when. You're a true patriot of the South. Make sure he gets a good life up there, she said. Yes, ma'am, the man replied. He returned to the car. We started moving. I slammed my hands against the rear window as the hulking frame of my aunt grew smaller and finally disappeared. The men drove toward the Mississippi River. I cried and called out for my mother. As soon as we were away from the meeting place, the shorter of the men turned around and slapped me across the face. I don't give a shit whose nephew you are, he said. You keep squealing like that, and I'll break your goddamn jaw. I slunk back, stunned. I tasted the dull iron of blood in my mouth. It was the first time anyone had ever hit me. The men waited till nightfall to cross the river. They crossed in an old rebel skiff under moonless night. Welcome to Purple Country, kid, the short man said. Nothing but cowards and traitors, far as the eye can see. For weeks, we drove westward. The men refused to travel during daylight hours or to take major roads. The landscape turned alien. Vast trays of sand, pierced by mesas colored caramel and orange. The desert was endless and littered with the wreckage of tanks and planes and makeshift camps from the earliest days of the war. They fed me nothing but old ration packs, meat in the form of powder and sickly sweet apricot gel that was designed never to go bad. Sometimes we stopped in small, run-down villages manned by soldiers whose uniforms I'd never seen before. The people spoke a different language, and I couldn't read the street signs. Sometimes the soldiers pointed their rifles at my two kidnappers and asked them what their business was in the Protectorado. It was during these times I thought of screaming for help, but the shorter man told me if I opened my mouth, he'd kill me. One day, the desert ended, and a parched, desolate forest replaced it. The forest, too, seemed to stretch forever, but there was not a single living thing within it. Everywhere around me, I was surrounded by the after effects of a fire. By the time we reached the Pacific, I could no longer tell the days and weeks apart. The men camped in the concrete remains of a desalination plant, half submerged in the water. The sound of waves crashing against the side of the building became maddening as the weeks went by. I gathered from the two men's conversations that the smuggler's ship that was to take us from this place had capsized, and it would be another month before the next one came. We waited. Every night, the men listened to a small radio for news. For weeks, there was nothing, and then a burst of reports of a mystery illness radiating from Columbus, and then nothing again. A vessel arrived in late October. It was an old fiberglass crabber, badly beaten and ill-suited for the ocean. From the moment the men dragged me on board, I was green with seasickness. The trip north was slow and rough. The captain kept close to the shoreline, and often the men cursed him and said he was going to run us ashore. Then one day I looked out the cabin window to see a strange city, alight with floating glitter. As we neared the port, I saw places in the water where previous ships had run into the submerged barrier reefs. You made it, kid, the shorter man said. New Anchorage, the neutral state. Welcome home. Excerpted from Hearing Before the Committee for Truth and Reunification, 163rd Congress, December 1, 2123. Members present, Senator Eli Thompson, new reunificationist, Arkansas, chair. Senator Barbara Akins, Democrat, Cascadia, Oregon, vice chair. Senator Peter Jindal, new reunificationist, Missouri,
Senator Clay Norman, Democrat, Illinois. Senator Bernard Willis, Democrat, Indiana. Witnesses: Colonel Barrett Singer, retired. Senator Thompson.
Good morning, everyone. If we can get the screen up and running, I think we can pick up where we left off yesterday. Senator Akins?
Senator Akins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, before we go back to the surveillance footage, I just wanted to ask you about something you mentioned yesterday, about the two soldiers who were manning the Rossville checkpoint, Private Martin Baker and, what was the other one's name again?
Colonel Singer.
Bud Baker, Jr.
Senator Akins.
That's right. Thank you. You mentioned yesterday that they were, let me see, in your words, wired for kinetics rather than border guard duty. Is that correct?
Colonel Singer.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Akins. And what exactly did you mean by that, Colonel?
Colonel Singer.
Well, certain young men, as soon as they arrive at the recruiter's office, you can tell. What I mean is, if it had still been a hot war, I wouldn't have assigned those boys to guard duty.
Senator Willis.
I think it's pretty clear what the colonel is saying, Senator. Those two boys were mean sons of bitches.
Colonel Singer.
That would be an accurate description.
Senator Willis.
Can't say I blame them with what they'd been through.
Senator Akins.
Thank you, Colonel. Let's go back to the video. Now, my understanding is that this is the only surviving footage of the crossing on that day.
Colonel Singer.
That's all we've got left, is the overhead. No ground level, no audio.
Senator Akins.
So, at the end of the day, we're left with what exactly? Conjecture? A guess?
Colonel Singer.
Well, ma'am, what we do know is that shortly before the first cases appeared in Columbus, the same sickness was noted in the hospital to which this particular bus was headed. So there is some reason to believe that the person responsible for the virus could have come across the border on that bus.
Senator Akins.
But we have no manifest, no hospital records.
Colonel, we don't even know the name of anyone on this video except your two soldiers.
Colonel Singer.
That's right, ma'am. Obviously, the decade of the reunification plague decimated many parts of this country, and countless records were lost. We're left only with what survived.
Senator Akins.
Very well. Let's play it. So the medical transport bus arrives at the checkpoint that day at around noon. Is that correct?
Colonel Singer.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Akins.
And there were no other vehicles or convoys of any kind cleared for passage to the north that day?
Colonel Singer.
That's right. It was 2 days to the reunification ceremony. The entire southern border was on lockdown.
Senator Akins.
So the two soldiers at the Rossville checkpoint would have known ahead of time that this bus was to be allowed through.
Colonel Singer.
They would have known it was an authorized vehicle, but we would never tell our soldiers to simply let a vehicle through. They would have known they would be expected to inspect the vehicle and check the paperwork of every passenger. Same as they would with anyone trying to come north from the red.
Senator Akins.
So, if we can go ahead and skip to the point where the passengers disembark?
Yes, thank you.
Now, at this point, one of the two young men, Private Martin Baker, I believe, is still inside the guard building. So what we have here is his brother, Bud Baker Jr., essentially ordering the passengers to line up for individual inspection. Is that correct, Colonel?
Colonel Singer.
Yes, ma'am. Again, standard procedure.
Senator Akins.
Now, I see that with the first two patients in line, Private Bud Jr. is perhaps a bit curt, but those interactions take just a minute or two. When he sees the third patient, however, I think it's fairly evident that his demeanor changes, wouldn't you say?
Colonel Singer.
I suppose.
Senator Akins.
Any idea why?
Colonel Singer.
Could be the size of the individual. You can see she appears to be a fairly intimidating woman from a physical standpoint. Could be because she appears to be much younger than the first two people in line. Could be she reminded him of someone or he thought he'd seen her before. Could be he just got a bad vibe from her, an instinctual thing.